Thank you. And now, Pastor Comparé.
Well, for some years, I've been talking to you folks about things that are in the Bible. And tonight I decided to talk about the Bible itself. How we got it, where it came from, what they did with it in the process. As you know, of course, the Old Testament was written in Hebrew. Now, we have no record of or any reason to believe that there were different versions of the Hebrew back in Old Testament days. There was no reason for it. They had the original manuscripts to start with, and they were copied carefully by the scribes. And while human errors would no doubt creep in occasionally, a slip of a pen or a careless copyist omitting a word or something of that sort, in general, they maintained a pretty thorough accuracy. Now, among the Dead Sea Scrolls, there's a practically complete book of Isaiah, and there is not one important difference from the book of Isaiah as we have it today. In Old Testament days, we have no indication that they ever tried to put it all together as one book, the Old Testament. The writings of the different prophets were separate books, and they weren't in book form as we know it today, a number of pages bound along one margin, but they were in scroll form. Some of them on papyrus. The papyrus was prepared from the pith of a reed that grew very profusely in the swamps in the delta of the Nile, and they would slice that into thin slices. Then they would lay these slices side by side, edges touching. Then they'd get a second set of slices, and they would lay those crosswise of the first and let them dry that way, because at the start, of course, this tip was rather moist. And then, when it had dried sufficiently, the plant juices were somewhat glue-like, they gave it an additional rubbing with some smooth thing to make the two layers stick together even better and give a good smooth surface to write on. Then they would take sheet after sheet of the papyrus and lay them side by side and glue the edges until they assembled a roll, 15, 20 feet or so in length. And that they rolled up on wooden spools at either end, and that was the scroll. And one book, like Isaiah, made up a separate book. So you had these manuscripts of the different books of the Old Testament. Well, besides the authentic writings, why, of course, there have been, in every age of which we have any record at all, religious cranks who like to put forth their views. And there were some of those in ancient times, too. And while no doubt some people believed some of these things, the general good judgment rejected them. Now, you've heard the term canon used. It signifies the group of books that are recognized as authentic. There's a canon of the Old Testament and a canon of the New Testament. And by 120 B.C., the canon of the recognized books of the Old Testament was pretty well settled. Now, it's true that an official canon wasn't adopted until about 100 A.D. But nonetheless, everybody knew from 120 B.C. that certain books were accepted as authentic and others were rejected as not being inspired. Well, this went on with the Hebrew Old Testament in common use, and you might note something about the Hebrew writing. Prior to the Babylonian captivity, they used an entirely different alphabet, which has been commonly known as Phoenician, because the first examples of it that we found in modern times were from Phoenician cities. But we know now that that same alphabet was used in Jerusalem prior to the Babylonian captivity. When they came back from the Babylonian captivity, most of them were using the square letter Hebrew alphabet as it's recognized today. Now, the old so-called Phoenician alphabet wasn't entirely abandoned. The inscriptions on some coins issued during the Maccabee period, from, say, 150 B.C., are in the old so-called Phoenician alphabet. But in general, it was abandoned and forgotten. Now, in the square letter Hebrew, they originally had only the consonant letters. Vowels were not developed and used until, well, the earliest record we have would be roughly 700 A.D. Now, it did involve some problems. To parallel it in English, suppose you take the letters B, T. Does it mean bat? Does it mean bet? Does it mean bit or bite or boat or butt? What vowel you put in there can make a great deal of difference in meaning. Now, of course, as far as the scriptures were concerned, they were supposed to be, and except for some periods of apostasy in the priesthood, they were in constant study and constant use in the temple, and the Levites were all supposedly familiar with this and scattered through the country teaching the people. So where there was room for possible doubt, you could change a word by changing a vowel in it. It didn't actually make a practical problem during that time, because everybody that had occasion to use the scrolls knew what it was supposed to be. Well, about 100 A.D., there was an official Jewish adoption of a canon. While, as I say, it had been recognized in practice, it was made official by the Jewish authorities. Now, they repudiated the Greek Septuagint, partly because the Septuagint translated, probably around 285 to 250 or so B.C., included some apocryphal books that were not recognized in the Hebrew canon. And there were some other differences also. Remember, the Hebrew canon wasn't recognized even unofficially till about 120 B.C. So you have the Septuagint nearly a century and a half before that, and they included these other books of, to be charitable, very doubtful value. Now, along with the adoption of an official canon, there was an official text, the Soferim text. Sofer means scribe. And you had this definite profession of scribes, and while undoubtedly they had occasion to do some writing of commercial manuscripts and contracts, that sort of thing, but their chief occupation was the copying of scrolls of the scriptures. and they adopted some elaborate rules to prevent errors in copying. On each line, they would note the number of words and then the number of letters in that line. And when the scribe had made his copy, he was to count up and see that if the number of letters and the number of words were identical, in addition to just reading it over to see if it apparently made the same sense as the original. Now, it was recognized that there would be some errors, some slips of the pen, and if these were not serious, if they didn't change the meaning, they were allowed to get by. Though the rule was, if more than three errors of any kind were found in a page, it had to be discarded. It couldn't be used. So, when from a century earlier than that, you have this manuscript of Isaiah in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and with no significant difference from what we have today, you can see that their rules to prevent copying errors worked reasonably well. In fact, the copying errors really became serious from about 700 A.D. on. That was the Masoretic text. Masora means tradition. And so this was the traditional text. It was a revision of the Sopharim text. And the big change was that at this time they added the vowel letters to give the traditional pronunciation that the school of the scribes and rabbis at Tiberias had had for many generations. Now, in the Hebrew, you started with nothing but the consonant letters, and they were written on the line and close together, and there was no room to put vowel letters in between them. In fact, they were written so close together that in many of the manuscripts, it's a little bit of a problem to decipher them because there wasn't even a significant space between words. Now what to do when you want to add vowel letters? So they developed a number of little vowel letters about the size of periods and commas, which were written underneath the line, and in one or two instances, even some little dot above a letter would change its pronunciation. And now you began to get complications. In writing these little vowel letters, if the scribe's pen happened to be a little bit dry when he started, he might wind up with a different vowel than he intended to put in and would have put in if the pen had held ink enough to go a 64th of an inch farther. Then again, these dots that were put above some letters to change the pronunciation. If the manuscript was written with the lines rather close together, it might get to be a problem to tell whether that dot was above a letter on the lower line or below a letter on the upper line. And if it was below a letter on the upper line, then that dot was a vowel. So, the errors in the Hebrew manuscript, as far as any serious errors are concerned, really started with the Masoretic text about 700 A.D. It was revised and corrected in the 10th century A.D. by Ben Asher. That's the final form of the Masoretic text in use today, and substantially all our current Bibles that base the Old Testament on the Hebrew manuscript are based on this Masoretic text as revised by Ben Asher. It's interesting to note what the scribes did in copying these manuscripts. Now, especially with the matter of these vowels, which could change the meaning of a word very considerably. Suppose a scribe is copying from a manuscript where he doesn't think that's what the word ought to be. Let's suppose it's the case where the mistake is so glaringly obvious that it just doesn't make good sense at all, the way it's written. Could the scribe correct it? Not by changing the manuscript. He copied the error. No matter how obvious, he copied it exactly. Then out in the margin, he wrote the correction, what the word should be, so that in reading it, you would come across in the text the erroneous word, but then from the margin you would pick up the word that it should be. Well, while that seems a bit funny to us, nevertheless, it was the right way to handle the thing, undoubtedly. Because if you began letting every scribe use his personal judgment as to whether that word ought to be changed in the text or not, then you would get into problems. So they handled it the best way they could. Now, you remember that when the northern kingdom, Israel, went into captivity, the Assyrians brought other people, mostly from around Babylon, and settled them in Samaria. And the Bible records that they were moved in there after the land had been vacant for some years and wild animals had multiplied till they were quite a pest. So these pagans who were moved in, they'd been praying to their own gods and nothing happened. So they sent word back to Assyria, "We don't know how to worship the god of this land who will take care of this wild animal problem for us, so send us a priest from some of the Israelite captives." So a priest or two was sent to them. Now they kept their paganism, but they tried to adopt in addition to it the Old Testament worship as they understood it. And they even eventually set up a rival temple there. If you read the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, you'll see the problems that came when the people returned to build Jerusalem after the Babylonian captivity. The people of Samaria said, "Well, we'll join with you in helping to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem because we also worship Yahweh." But the returned exiles would have nothing to do with them. They weren't racially of any tribe of Israel, and they still had some paganism in their religion. Now, of what scriptures they had, the only thing that has survived to us today is a Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. There are several of these known. The earliest existing copy today dates from about the 10th century. It's written in the old so-called Phoenician script. So evidently they had gotten a hold of a copy that hadn't been destroyed at the time of the Babylonian conquest. Now, it is not exactly the same as either the Hebrew as we have it today or the Greek translation, the Septuagint. But it does shed some light on what they had back in those ancient times. Now, another thing you may read about are the Targums. Now, these are not translations. They are paraphrases. The scriptures, of course, the Old Testament, were written in Hebrew, and they remained in Hebrew. Now, when the people came back from Babylon, Hebrew was a dead language except to the priests and scribes. They knew Hebrew because they were working constantly with the manuscripts of the Old Testament scriptures. The rest of the people spoke Aramaic. Now, Aramaic is another Semitic dialect, closely related to Hebrew, but not identical with it. Nevertheless, there are some different words, some different pronunciations, and in the synagogue, when the scriptures were read, most of the people couldn't understand it in the Hebrew. So, a verse or two would be read in the Hebrew. Then somebody had to translate it into Aramaic for the benefit of the congregation. At first, they only allowed oral translations from the Hebrew into the Aramaic. Later, they allowed the use of written translations for private study only. They wouldn't allow a written translation into Aramaic to be read in the synagogue, because that would seem to be putting it on a par with the Hebrew manuscript that had been read. And the Talmud records an incident later than 100 A.D. in which a Targum manuscript was confiscated and destroyed because it had been used beyond the permissible manner. Eventually, however, they were allowed to have these written Aramaic translations, even for use in the synagogue. Now, what they did, they didn't make just a literal translation. They started out, to begin with, using a paraphrase to make it clearer, because even the idiom of the Hebrew is not always identical with the idiom of the Aramaic. So they would rephrase it to make it a little bit clearer, and the writer of the Targum, trying to make it clear, would add his own additional explanations and arguments. So that in the Targums, basically, you don't have a translation at all. You have a paraphrase, a rephrasing in the writer's own idea of what the original meant, no matter what it said. And they are therefore of no value at all as any guide to what the early Hebrew manuscripts said. But, as I say, the Masoretic text has come down to us with not too many errors. Most of the differences between the different manuscripts really come from errors in these tiny little vowel points. True, it changes one word to another, but you can see how it happened. Then, you have the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint. According to the tradition, this was translated, the entire Old Testament, in 72 days by 72 Jewish scholars who had been sent from Jerusalem to Alexandria about 270 to 280 B.C. at the request of the Egyptian King Ptolemy Philadelphus. Well, that they were sent at his request is unquestionably true. But that they did the job in a brief time is inherently unbelievable. There were two magnificent libraries at Alexandria in Egypt at that time, and the various Egyptian kings were eager to make it the great center of learning of the world. And there is no doubt that the legend, if you want to call it that, is definitely true, that to build up the library at Alexandria, they wanted a Greek version of the Old Testament. Now, it's true that a lot of Jews had settled in Alexandria, but nevertheless, most of the people there couldn't read Hebrew, and so they did need a Greek text. Greek had become an important language in Egypt because, you remember, it was part of Alexander the Great's empire, and on the breakup at his death, that was one of the four kingdoms that was established under the Ptolemy king. Well, we know definitely that the first part of it to be issued were the first five books of the Bible. And the indications are that to complete the Old Testament took several years. Since there was no accepted canon, the Septuagint does, as I said, include some apocryphal books which were rejected in Palestine. Now, as to the quality of the Greek language used in the Septuagint, various parts of the Septuagint show great differences in ability on the part of the translators, great differences in knowledge of the Greek language. Some parts are done in beautifully polished Greek, and some are awkward and bungled because those parts were done by somebody who just simply didn't know his Greek very well. Now, there are a number of differences between the Septuagint and the accepted Hebrew manuscript. As I say, first of all, it includes these apocryphal books which the Hebrew rejected. Secondly, there are quite a number of places where a sentence is broken off in the middle, you might say, in the Septuagint, when it was substantially longer, contained additional words in the Hebrew. And likewise, there are quite a number of sentences in the Septuagint that run on to contain additional material not found in the Hebrew. Then there are a number of word differences which change the meaning quite considerably, and some of them definitely intentional. Others might be just errors of a copyist. Now, a papyrus manuscript, of course, being only a form of paper, naturally wore out after a while. Now, the custom among the Jews was, when a manuscript wore out to the point where it was no longer substantially useful, it was becoming torn or obliterated, it was buried. They would bury it in a cemetery beside the grave of some noted rabbi, or in some cases it was walled up in a synagogue wall. A new copy, of course, had been made to replace it. And the thing is true, even when you get into the Aramaic manuscripts from farther east, Syria, Babylon, Persia, because it was thought not fitting to let a sacred thing like this simply become trash when it was no longer usable for the purpose for which it was made, why it was buried or otherwise destroyed. So if you're wondering why don't we have any manuscripts of the Old Testament in either Hebrew or Greek going way back thousands of years, like some of the Egyptian papyri that have been found, the answer is no, they were deliberately destroyed. Now, the earliest existing manuscript of the Septuagint probably doesn't go back earlier than 1000 A.D. The earlier ones had served their time and been destroyed. In most of those that we have, where the name of God is mentioned, in the Hebrew, Yahweh, in translating it into Greek, they had substituted either the Greek theos, meaning God, or kurios, meaning Lord. However, some quite early fragmentary manuscripts of it have been discovered, in which, although it is written in Greek, where they come to the name of God, Yahweh, those four Hebrew letters are copied into it, and in the old so-called Phoenician Hebrew script. So it shows that at that time, the corruption hadn't fully set in. A copy existing today, dating from about the 2nd century B.C., I have a book with some photographs in it of some pages from that, showing that in this otherwise Greek manuscript, here is Yahweh in Hebrew. Now, even Jerome, who wrote the Vulgate translation in Latin in the early part of the 4th century A.D., Jerome, in his writings, mentions the Septuagint, still using the word Yahweh instead of Kurios. So it shows that the change there was a later corruption. Now, some of our self-admitted scholars who like to think themselves infallible, because in Western Europe they had the Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, they assure us, oh, it was all originally written in Greek. Oh, everybody in Palestine spoke Greek. It was a universal language. And if they'd only go back and look at the historical records, they would know that they are merely ignorant and stupid. Now, when they came back from the Babylonian captivity, these people realized that they'd gone into that captivity because they had not been faithful to their religion. And they determined to follow it right to the letter with mechanical strictness after they got back. Now, at first, of course, they were ruled as part of the Persian Empire. But then Alexander overthrew the Persian Empire, and upon his death, the Seleucids, who took over the Syrian and Palestinian part of Alexander's empire, they were determined that they were going to make their kingdom Greek in culture. Now, they were pagans, and they tried to dominate Palestine. They tried to compel the adoption of paganism, pagan temples being set up, pagan worship. And of course, they were bitterly resisted by the Jews in Judea. Finally, one Syrian king, Antiochus Epiphanes, determined to stamp out the worship of Yahweh. He invaded and desecrated the temple. That was Ezra's temple, of course, for that time in Jerusalem. Sacrificed a pig on the altar and gave orders that anybody sticking to the old worship was to be killed. Now, that provoked the Maccabee rebellion. Now, all this sort of thing was done by Greek-speaking people having Greek pagan culture and trying to enforce Greek paganism and customs on these people in Judea, and they weren't having any of it. So it became bitterly unpopular. The Maccabean Wars were very bitter and the suffering very great under it, and these people came out thoroughly embittered against anything Greek. Josephus brings out that very few people in Judea knew Greek. Josephus says he was one of the very few in Judea who were learned in Greek, as his nation greatly discouraged it. That's in his writing, Antiquities of the Jews, Book 20, Chapter 11. And in his other work, The Jewish Wars, in the preface to it, he says that he wrote it in his country's own language, and that the Parthians, that's part of Persia, the Parthians, the Babylonians, the remotest Arabians, and those of our nation beyond Euphrates received and read his books in the Aramaic, but that he would now translate it into Greek. In fact, it was said that it was considered as bad to learn Greek as to eat pork. Now, these self-styled scholars who say, oh, everything in the New Testament was written in Greek, they admit that there isn't any part of the New Testament that is Greek in thought or philosophy. There isn't any part of the New Testament that is Greek in its idiom or phraseology. It's all Aramaic in its idiom. So they say, well, now, these people all spoke Greek. It was their universal language. But they never thought in Greek. They thought in Aramaic. Now, that alone is enough to disqualify any man from the claim to be a scholar. Anybody who's ever studied a foreign language, if you've had so much as a year of high school French or something of that sort, you know that the hardest part of learning any foreign language is learning to think in it. In the early stages, when you want to say something in the language you're learning, you have to think it out in English and then mentally translate it before you can speak it. So this idea that they thought in Aramaic but wrote in Greek refutes itself very definitely. Now, there were some later Greek translations after the Septuagint. About 140 to 150 A.D., Aquila made a translation from the Hebrew into the Greek. This, of course, is Old Testament. And although he wrote in Greek, wherever the word Yahweh occurred, he used the four Hebrew letters, equivalent to our English YHWH, in his manuscript. It was intended to replace the Septuagint, but it was a practically literal translation of the Sopharim Hebrew text into Greek. Now, the idiom of the two languages is considerably different, so this made it such poor Greek that it never became popular. But it is valuable evidence as to what the Sopharim text was, even that early. It's quoted a number of times in writings of the early Christian fathers, and some fragments of it still exist. Symmachus, about 180 A.D., made a translation into Greek, and he didn't try to make it a literal translation. It was a very free translation. He was trying to convey into Greek idiom the Hebrew thought to make it good Greek, and he did a good job of it. It's quoted by the early Christian fathers, and some fragments of it still exist. Around that same time, about 180 A.D., Theodosian made a, well, it wasn't really a new translation. It was a revision of the Septuagint to put it into better Greek rather than a new version. Quite well done. Parts of it had been quoted by early Christian fathers. No fragment of it remains today. There were three other translations, evidently fairly commonly used, their authors unknown, ranging from around 180 to 200 A.D. pretty good Greek style. Fragments only exist. Then finally, you have the Hexapla by Origen. Now, what he did, on each page he put six parallel vertical columns because he was giving a comparison of six versions so you could see where the similarities and differences were. Column 1 was the Sophoran text of the Hebrew. Column 2 was the Sophoran text but transliterated into Greek. I don't mean translated, I mean simply the sound of the Hebrew reproduced in Greek letters as near as you had Greek letters for the same thing. Not trying to give the meaning in this case, but so somebody who read Greek would be able to pronounce it as it was pronounced in Hebrew. Column 3 contained Aquila's translation. Column 4, Seneca's translation.